Geekscape.com.
Famous Men of the Middle Ages, Part 3. Theodoric the Ostrogoth, king from 475 to 526 AD. The Ostrogoths, or East Goths, who had settled in southern Russia, at length pushed southwards and westwards to the mouth of the Danube. They were continually invading countries belonging to the Romans, and their warlike raids were dreaded by the emperors of the Eastern Roman Empire, who lived at Constantinople. One emperor gave them land and money, and thus stopped their invasions for a time. The most famous of the Ostrogoth kings was Theodoric the Great. He was the son of Theodomir, who was also a king of the Ostrogoths. When Theodoric was 8 years old, he was sent to Constantinople to be held as a hostage by Leo, the emperor of the East. In former times, when kings made treaties with one another, it was customary for one to give to the other a pledge or security that he would fulfil the conditions of the treaty. The pledge usually given was some important person or persons, perhaps the king's son or a number of his chief men. Persons so given as a security were called hostages. When Theodoric was a boy, he was given as a hostage for his father's good faith in carrying out a treaty with the emperor, and he was sent to Constantinople to live. Here, the youth was well treated by Leo. He was educated with great care and trained in all the exercises of war. Theodomir died in 475, and then Theodoric returned to his own country and became king of the Ostrogoths. At this time, he was 18 years of age. He was a handsome and brave man, and people loved him, for in those days a man who was tall and strong and brave was liked by everybody. For some years after he became king, Theodoric had frequent wars with other Gothic kings, and also with the Roman Emperor Zeno. He was nearly always successful in battle, and at last Zeno began to think it may be better to try and make friends with him. So he gave Theodoric some rich lands and made him commander of the imperial guard of Constantinople. But the emperor soon became tired of having this Ostrogoth king at his court, and to get rid of him, he agreed that Theodoric should go with his army to Italy and take that country from Odoacer. Theodoric was delighted at the proposal and began at once to make his preparations. Odoacer was at that time king of Italy, but before he became king, he had been a general in the army of Romulus Augustulus, the Western Roman Emperor. The soldiers of the army were not satisfied with their pay, and when they asked for more, they did not get it. Then they drove Romulus Augustulus from the throne and chose Odoacer to succeed him. But Odoacer would not take the name of emperor. He was called the Patrician of Italy, and he ruled the country well. Theodoric started for Italy, not only with a great army, but with all the people of his country. He meant to take Italy and be its king, and settle in it with all his Ostrogoths. When he set out, he had with him 250,000 persons, men, women, and children, with a great number of horses and wagons to carry them and their things. He had also an army of 60,000 brave soldiers. It was a long and weary journey from the shores of the Black Sea overland to the foot of the Alps mountains and across the Alps into Italy. Here and there on the way, they met savage tribes that tried to stop them, but Theodoric defeated the savages and took a great many of them as prisoners. He made these prisoners, women as well as men, help carry the baggage and do other work. The journey took months, but at last the Ostrogoths reached the top of the Alps. Then they could see, stretched out before them, the beautiful land of Italy. They were all delighted. They shouted and danced with joy. And Theodoric cried out, "There is the country which shall be our home. Let us march on, for it certainly shall be ours." Then they passed quickly down, and soon they were in Italy. Odoacer had heard of their coming, and he got ready an army to drive them away. Theodoric also got his fighting men ready. The two armies met, and there was a great battle near the town of Aquileia. Odoacer was defeated. Then he tried to get Theodoric to leave Italy by offering him a large sum of money. "I will give you," said he, "thousands of pounds of gold and silver if you agree to go back to your own country." But Theodoric would not go. He said he had as good a right to be king of Italy as Odoacer, and he would remain and conquer the country and be its king. Soon after, there was another battle near Verona, and Odoacer was again defeated. Theodoric came very near to being killed in this battle. He was saved only by the courage of his mother. She was in his camp, and at one time she saw a number of the Ostrogoths running away from that part of the battlefield where her son was fighting, thus leaving him without support. The mother rushed forwards and stopped the fleeing men. She made them feel that it was a shame for them to desert their leader, and they at once returned to the field and fought beside their king until the battle was won. After the Battle of Verona, Odoacer went with his army to the city of Ravenna and remained there for some time. Theodoric followed with his Ostrogoths and tried to take the city, but there was a very strong wall around it, and the Ostrogoths could not capture it. Although Theodoric was not able to take Ravenna, he did not remain idle. He marched off to other parts of the country and took possession of towns and districts wherever he went. After a while, Odoacer got together a better army than he had before and made another effort to defeat Theodoric. But he again failed. Theodoric defeated him in another great battle, which was fought on the banks of the river Adda. After this battle, Odoacer again fled to Ravenna. Theodoric followed again and laid siege to the city. This time, his army surrounded it and kept provisions from being sent in, and at last, when there was no food in the city for the soldiers or the people to eat, Odoacer had to surrender. A treaty was then made between the two kings, and both agreed that they should rule together over Italy, each to have equal power. But a few days afterwards, Theodoric murdered Odoacer while sitting at a banquet, and then made himself the sole ruler of Italy. He divided one third of the land of the country among his own followers, so the Ostrogoths settled in Italy, and Ostrogoths, Romans, and Visigoths were governed by Theodoric as one people. Theodoric died at the age of 71 after ruling Italy for 33 years.
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.
Clovis, king from 481 to 511 AD. While the power of the Roman Empire was declining, there dwelt on the banks of the River Rhine a number of savage Teuton tribes called Franks. The word Frank means free, and those tribes took pride in being known as Franks or freemen. The Franks occupied the east bank of the Rhine for about 200 years. Then, many of the tribes crossed the river in search of new homes. The region west of the river was at that time called Gaul. Here, the Franks established themselves and became a powerful people, From their name, the country was afterwards called France. Each tribe of the Franks had its own king. The greatest of all these kings was Clodowic, or Clovis, as we call him, who became ruler of his tribe in the year 481, just 6 years after Theodoric became king of the Ostrogoths. Clovis was then only 16 years of age, but though he was so young, he proved in a very short time that he could govern as well as any older man. He was intelligent and brave. No one ever knew him to be afraid of anything, even when he was but a child. His father, who was named Childeric, often took him to wars, which the Franks had with neighbouring tribes, and he was very proud of his son's bravery. The young man was also a bold and skilful horseman. He could tame and ride the most fiery of horses. When Clovis became king of the Franks, a great part of Gaul still belonged to Rome. This part was then governed by a Roman general named Syagrius. Clovis resolved to drive the Romans out of the country, and he talked over the matter with the head men of his army. "My desire," said he, "is that the Franks shall have possession of every part of this fair land. I shall drive the Romans and their friends away and make Gaul the empire of the Franks." At this time, the Romans had a great army in Gaul. It was encamped near the city of Soissons and was commanded by Syagrius. Clovis resolved to attack it and led his army at once to Soissons. When he came near the city, he summoned Syagrius to surrender. Syagrius refused and asked for an interview with the commander of the Franks. Clovis consented to meet him, and an arrangement was made that the meeting should take place in the open space between the two armies. When Clovis stepped out in front of his own army, accompanied by some of his savage warriors, Syagrius also came forward. But the moment he saw the king of the Franks, he laughed loudly and exclaimed, a boy has come to fight me. The Franks, with a boy to lead them, have come to fight the Romans." Clovis was very angry at this insulting language, and he shouted back, "Aye, but the boy will conquer you." Both sides then prepared for battle. The Romans thought that they would win the victory easily, but they were mistaken. Every time that they made a charge upon the Franks, they were beaten back by the warriors of Clovis. The young king himself fought bravely at the head of his men, and with his own sword struck down a number of Romans. He tried to find Syagrius and fight with him, but the Roman commander was nowhere to be found. Early in the battle, he had fled from the field, leaving his men to defend themselves as best they could. The Franks gained a great victory. With their gallant boy king leading them on, they drove the Romans before them, and when the battle was over, they took possession of the city of Soissons. Clovis afterwards conquered all the other Frankish chiefs and made himself king of all the Franks. Not very long after Clovis had become king, he heard of a beautiful young girl, the niece of Gondibord, king of Burgundy, and he thought he would like to marry her. Her name was Clotilda, and she was an orphan, for her wicked uncle Gondibord had killed her father and mother. Clovis sent one of his nobles to Gondibord to ask her for his wife. At first, Gondibord thought of refusing to let the girl go. He feared that she might have him punished for the murder of her parents if she became the wife of so powerful a man as Clovis. But he was also afraid that by refusing, he would provoke the anger of Clovis, so he permitted the girl to be taken to the court of the king of the Franks. Clovis was delighted when he saw her, and they were immediately married. Clotilda was a devout Christian, and she wished very much to convert her husband, who, like most of his people, was a worshipper of the heathen gods. But Clovis was not willing to give up his own religion. Nevertheless, Clotilda continued to do everything she could to persuade him to become a Christian. Soon after his marriage, Clovis had a war with a tribe called the Alemanni. This tribe had crossed the Rhine from Germany and taken possession of some of the eastern provinces of Gaul. Clovis speedily got his warriors together and marched against them. A battle was fought at a place called Tolbiac, not far from the present city of Cologne. In this battle, the Franks were nearly beaten, for the Alemanni were fierce and brave men, as well as skillful fighters. When Clovis saw his soldiers driven back several times, he began to lose hope. But at that very moment, he thought of his pious wife and of the powerful God of whom she had so often spoken. Then he raised his hands to heaven and earnestly prayed to that God. "O God of Clotilda," he cried, "help me in this my hour of need. If thou wilt give me victory now, I will believe in thee." Almost immediately, the course of the battle began to change in favour of the Franks. Clovis led his warriors forwards once more, and this time the Alemanni fled before them in terror. The Franks gained a great victory, and they believed it was in answer to the prayers of their king. When Clovis returned home, he did not forget his promise. He told Clotilda how he had prayed to her God for help, and how his prayer had been heard, and he said he was now ready to become a Christian. Clotilda was very happy on hearing this, and she arranged that her husband should be baptized in the church of Reims on the following Christmas Day. Meanwhile, Clovis issued a proclamation to his people, declaring that he was a believer in Christ, and giving orders that all the images and temples of the heathen gods should be destroyed. This was immediately done, and many of the people followed his example and became Christians. Clovis was a very earnest and fervent convert. One day, the Bishop of Reims, while instructing him in the doctrines of Christianity, described the death of Christ. As the bishop proceeded, Clovis became much excited, and at last jumped up from his seat and exclaimed, "Had I been there with my brave Franks, I would have avenged his wrongs." On Christmas Day, a great multitude assembled in the church at Reims to witness the baptism of the king. A large number of his fierce warriors were baptized at the same time. The service was performed with great ceremony by the Bishop of Reims, and the title of Most Christian King was conferred on Clovis by the Pope. This title was ever after borne by the kings of France. Like most of the kings and chiefs of those rude and barbarous times, Clovis often did cruel and wicked things. When Reims was captured, before he became a Christian, a golden vase was taken by some soldiers from the church. The bishop asked Clovis to have it returned, and Clovis bade him wait until the division of spoils. All the valuable things taken by soldiers in war were divided among the whole army, each man getting his share according to his rank. Such things were called spoils. When the next time came for dividing spoils, Clovis asked that he might have the vase over and above his regular share, his intention being to return it to the bishop. But one of the soldiers objected, saying that the king should have no more than his fair share, and at the same time shattered the vase with his axe. Clovis was very angry, but at the time he said nothing. Soon after, however, there was the usual examination of the arms of the soldiers to see that they were in proper condition for active service. Clovis himself took part in the examination, and when he came to the soldier who had broken the vase, he found fault with the condition of his weapons, and with one blow of his battle-axe struck the man dead. The next war that Clovis engaged in was with some tribes of the Goths who occupied the country called Aquitaine, lying south of the River Loire. He defeated them and added Aquitaine to the kingdom of the Franks. Clovis afterwards made war upon other people of Gaul and defeated them as well. At last, all the provinces from the Lower Rhine to the Pyrenees Mountains were compelled to acknowledge him as king. He then went to reside at the city of Paris, which he made the capital of his kingdom. He died there in 511 AD. The dynasty, or family of kings to which he belonged, is known to history as the Merovingian dynasty. It was so called from Merovaeus, the father of Childeric and the grandfather of Clovis.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Justinian the Great, Emperor from 527 to 565 AD. In the time of Clovis, the country now called Bulgaria was inhabited by Goths. One day, a poor shepherd boy, about 16 years of age, left his mountain home in that country to go to the city of Constantinople, which was many miles away. The boy had no money to pay the expenses of the journey, but he was determined to go, even though he should have to walk every step of the way and live on fruits that he could gather by the road. He was a bright, clever boy who had spent his life hitherto in a village, but was now eager to go out into the world to seek his fortune. Some years before, this boy's uncle, who was named Justin, had gone to Constantinople and joined the Roman army. He was so brave and so good a soldier that he soon came to be commander of the imperial guard which attended the emperor. The poor shepherd boy had heard of the success of his uncle, and this was the reason why he resolved to set off for the big city. So he started down the mountain and trudged along the valley in high hopes, feeling certain that he would reach the end of his journey in safety. It was a difficult and a dangerous journey, and it took him several weeks, for he had to go through dark forests and cross rivers and high hills. But at last, one afternoon in midsummer, he walked through the main gate of Constantinople, proud and happy that he had accomplished his purpose. He had no trouble in finding his uncle Justin, for everybody in Constantinople knew the commander of the emperor's guards. And when the boy appeared at the great man's house and told who he was, his uncle received him with much kindness. He took him into his own family and gave him the best education that could be had in the city. As the boy was very talented and eager for knowledge, he soon became an excellent scholar. He grew up a tall, good-looking man, with black eyes and curly hair, and he was always richly dressed. He was well-liked at the emperor's court, and was respected by everyone on account of his learning. One day, a great change came for both uncle and nephew. The emperor died, and the people chose Justin to succeed him. He took the title of Justinus I, and so the young scholar, who had once been a poor shepherd boy, was now nephew to the emperor. After some years, Justinus was advised by his nobles to take the young man, who had adopted the name of Justinian, to help him in ruling the empire. Justinus agreed to this proposal, for he was now old and in feeble health, and not able himself to attend to the important affairs of government. He therefore called the great lords of his court together, and in their presence he placed a crown on the head of his nephew, who thus became joint emperor with his uncle. The uncle died only a few months after, and then Justinian was declared emperor. This was in the year 527. Justinian reigned for nearly 40 years and did so many important things that he was afterwards called Justinian the Great. He had many wars during his reign, but he himself did not take part in them. He was not experienced as a soldier, for he had spent most of his time in study. He was fortunate enough, however, to have two great generals to lead his armies. One of them was named Belisarius, and the other Narses. Belisarius was one of the greatest soldiers that has ever lived. He gained wonderful victories for Justinian and conquered back some of the old Roman provinces that had been lost for many years. The victories of these two generals largely helped to make the reign of Justinian remarkable in history. Many years before he ascended the throne, the Vandals, as you have heard, conquered the northern part of Africa and established a kingdom there with Carthage as its capital. The Vandal king in the time of Justinian was named Gelimer, and he lived in Carthage. Justinian resolved to make war upon this king in order to recover northern Africa and make it again a part of the empire. So Belisarius was sent to Africa with an army of 35,000 men and 5,000 horses that were carried on a fleet of 600 ships. It took this fleet 3 months to make the voyage from Constantinople to Africa. The same voyage may now be made in a very few days, but in the time of Belisarius there were no steamships, and nothing was known of the power of steam for moving machinery. The ships or galleys were sailing vessels, and when there was no wind they could make no progress except by rowing. When Belisarius reached Africa, he left 5 men as a guard in each vessel, and with the body of his army, he marched for some days along the coast. The people received him in a friendly way, for they had grown tired of the rule of the Vandals, and preferred to be under the government of the Romans. About 10 miles from Carthage, he met a large army led by the brother of Gelimer. A battle immediately took place, and the Vandals were utterly defeated. Gelimer's brother was killed, and the king himself, who had followed with another army and joined in the fight, was also defeated and fled from the field. Belisarius then proceeded to Carthage and took possession of the city. Soon after, Gelimer collected another army and fought the Romans in another battle, 20 miles from Carthage, but Belisarius again defeated him, and the Vandal king again fled. This was the end of the Vandal kingdom in Africa. In a short time, Gelimer gave himself up to Belisarius, who took him to Constantinople. Justinian set apart an estate for him to live upon, and the conquered king passed the rest of his life in peaceful retirement. After conquering the Vandals, Justinian resolved to conquer Italy, which was then held by the Ostrogoths. A large army was got together and put under the command of Belisarius and Narses, who immediately set out for Italy. When they arrived there, they marched straight to Rome, and after some fighting, took possession of the city. But in a few months, Vitiges, king of the Goths, appeared with an army before the gates and challenged Belisarius and Narses to come out and fight. The Roman generals, however, were not then ready to fight, and so the Ostrogoth king laid siege to the city, thinking that he would compel the Romans to surrender. But instead of having any thought of surrender, Belisarius was preparing his men for fight, and when they were ready, he attacked Vitiges and defeated him. Vitiges retired to Ravenna, and Belisarius quickly followed and made such an assault on the city that it was compelled to surrender. The Ostrogoth army was captured, and Vitiges was taken to Constantinople as a prisoner. Belisarius and Narses then went to northern Italy, and after a long war, conquered all the tribes there. Thus, the power of Justinian was established throughout the whole country, and the city of Rome was again under the dominion of a Roman emperor. While his brave generals were winning these victories for the empire, Justinian himself was busy in making improvements of various kinds at the capital. He erected great public buildings, which were not only useful but ornamental to the city. The most remarkable of them was the very magnificent Cathedral of San Sofia, for a long time the grandest church structure in the world. The great temple still exists in all its beauty and grandeur, but is now used as a Mohammedan mosque. But the most important thing that Justinian did, the work for which he is most celebrated, was the improving and collecting of the laws. He made many excellent new laws, and reformed many of the old ones, so that he became famous as one of the greatest of the world's legislators. For a long time, the Roman laws had been difficult to understand. There was a vast number of them, and different writers differed widely as to what the laws really were and what they meant. Justinian employed a great lawyer named Tribonian to collect and simplify the principal laws. The collection which he made was called the Code of Justinian. It still exists, and is the model according to which most of the countries of Europe have made their laws. Justinian also did a great deal of good by establishing a number of manufactures in Constantinople. It was he who first brought silkworms into Europe. To the last year of his life, Justinian was strong and active and a hard worker. He often worked or studied all day and all night without eating or sleeping. He died in 565 at the age of 83 years.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.